Wednesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. I'm guessing very few of you actually watched any NBA tonight because of that awesome World Series Game 7. I make fun of baseball, and it's not my favorite anymore, but being from Chicago, I can at least, though I'm no longer a fan, I can at least appreciate that everyone in Chicago is really happy right now. I can appreciate that there will be some good reverse 3-1 memes on Clevelanders now. But let's get to some games. We'll talk a little bit about Bulls Celtics and about Wizards and Raptors. Haven't had a chance to break down games from either of these teams yet. And then also we're going to do another part of our Reddit mailbag because we had so many good questions. These ones get a little bit more whimsical at times. So we hope you'll enjoy that. We're sponsored today by Movement Watches. Find out more about them at MVMTwatches.com/capspace. And then our old friends at Indochino as well. You can get a custom made suit for a mere $389 at Indochino.com when entering that Capspace code at checkout. Danny, good evening.
Good evening. Yeah, I mean, this was an interesting night of basketball that was just somewhat superseded by an amazing night in baseball. But I mean, I think we should start with Washington-Toronto because especially early on in this game, John Wall was playing some spectacular basketball.
Yeah, he was. And it was really, this was all of the good John Wall at his absolute best. And they burst out to a 27-15. Lead, and then all of a sudden the Wizards reserves came in and got absolutely smoked, and it was basically a tie game by the end of the first quarter when Wall went out. And Wall was 13 out of 19 from the field, 7-9 from the line, 11 assists, but the two, and I will say that's very encouraging. Like he was pretty good defensively too, pushing the ball in transition. He was fantastic. But and also I think my concerns that he wouldn't be the same guy potentially after that knee injury, I think have been alleviated with his start to the year. But he also doesn't look like he's been able to add much, understandably, because he can't hit a jump shot and he turned the ball over 9 times. Those are the two things that really bothered about him. And Wall, he made 13 out of 15 within 8 feet and was 0-for-4 outside of 8 feet. So he's a great player. He's not the reason that they lost this game, but, and it's good to see him back, but also he still has a lot of work to do, I think, to take the next step to really being the type of player that's going to push the Wizards into a new strata in the league.
Yeah, I mean, you could see his physical dominance at moments of this game. You know, the fact that he can just get
Jonas Valanciunas and Jakob Poeltl had a great view of his physical dominance in the pick and roll in this game, that's for sure.
Yeah, and so you remember that with him, and just the part of what was always so intriguing about him back even when he was a draft prospect was the idea that if he could put it together, he had some special building blocks. And for lots of reasons that are understandable, and some just the idea that improving as much as he would need to put it all together is really hard. You know, he's gotten to a level that I'm sure a lot of people would be happy with, but it's just not all the way there yet. And so, you know, the jump shot is a big part of that. And just being an overall consistent positive offensive force is hard without that, kind of with or without your teammates' cooperation.
His foil in this game was DeMar DeRozan, who has been absolutely on fire so far this year. DeRozan, 14 out of 23 from the field, got to the foul line for 16 shots as well, had 5 assists, 40 points, and only 1 turnover. That is one thing that DeRozan probably doesn't get enough credit for, is the fact that he rarely turns it over. A lot of that's because he's doing kind of his ISO game and not taking a ton of risks necessarily with his passes and just kind of going to where he's comfortable. But he was just absolutely on fire from mid-range. From mid-range, he shot 10 out of 16 from outside the lane, only took 5 shots in the lane, a pretty amazing and a 40 point performance. And most of his fouls even were plays where he was more just getting his usual kind of BS fouls on the perimeter. Did shoot 1 out of 2 from 3-point range as well. But this really, to me, showed some of the weakness that Washington has defensively against guys who are strong, powerful ISO scorers on the wing. They don't have anybody to stop those guys.
They don't. And, you know, I think they hoped and expected that Otto Porter could become that guy, and you know, maybe against certain opponents he can, but strength players is just not the right well suited for him, and DeRozan's too big for Beal.
Yeah, that's right. And Porter also not really a great defender in isolation because he just doesn't really have the quick reaction and the explosion to get up and challenge those shots without fouling. And then when they go to the bench, it's Kelly Oubre, who of course just got baited into fouls and wasn't able to stay disciplined on DeRozan either. And it wasn't that unit that always kills it on the bench for the Raptors with Kyle Lowry playing at point guard while DeRozan is out. It was DeRozan and Poeltl and some of the other guys off the bench, Patterson, who Corey really Joseph, took it to, who took it to that Wizards second unit that didn't really have any of their stars in there. Trey Burke had a pretty rough game, and the Wizards overall turned the ball over a ton. Burke had 3 turnovers in just 6 minutes and was negative 11. Scott Brooks actually had to go to Thomas Satoransky in the second half, and Satoransky kind of played well. Although he also gave some concerns for me defensively, because I think he's just not strong enough for wings. He was completely overmatched on DeRozan, and he's going to be too slow for point guards. He's 6'6", but he doesn't have a ton of length, just a 6'7 wingspan, and he's pretty thin. So it looked like he could be a liability, but he at least, you know, wasn't screwing up, and that's, I think, why Scott Brooks went to him.
And beyond the Wizards turning the ball over, 16 of their 20 were live ball, and that's just devastating against a team, because even if you're playing good half-court defense, if the disparity is 16-8 like it was in this game, that makes a really tough margin, because those are the hardest things to defend. And something else I want to mention, because it was such a big point in this game, even though it was early and it stayed close after that, was when John Wall left, and I think it was about 3 minutes left in the first quarter, the Wizards were up 12. They had played great up to that point. And I think they kept Beal in, but pretty much everybody else was the bench mob. And they got absolutely smoked. When they started the second quarter, they brought Gortat in, but it was too little too late. And when
Gortat had to play 43 minutes in this game, by the way.
Good thing.
And the pick and roll with he and Wall was absolutely unstoppable. Like, Gortat is a great screener. He was just obliterating whoever it was at the point of attack. Like, Kyle Lowry couldn't do anything with him. And then it was just Wall going right downhill at Valanciunas and Poeltl and just scooting right by him for layups time and again. And then finding, you know, when they brought in guys from the wings, he was of course finding guys for threes, which the Wizards didn't take a ton of threes, but Wall was the one who set up a couple of them.
So they had that 12-point lead, and then when Wall returned to the game, they were only up 1, and I don't remember, I also admittedly wasn't following it super closely after that point, I don't remember the Wizards ever really pushing it then. It kind of stayed nip and tuck until the Raptors took control.
Yeah, the Raptors actually got up, and then that unit was Satoransky, and then Wall came back in the fourth, brought them back to tied, and then the Wizards just couldn't score at the end, could not get a stop to save their lives against DeRozan. That's really in that fourth quarter is when he was going absolutely crazy on just tough mid-rangers that you frankly, unless you have a real wing stopper like a Paul George type, you're not going to be able to do anything out there. They didn't have anybody who could make DeRozan remotely uncomfortable. And there's a huge difference between taking a technically contested mid-ranger over a guy that you know you can get the shot off of, so the contest is not going to get in your head, versus someone like a Paul George where it's like, oh, this guy might actually be close enough to block my shot, and now you're going to rush it a little bit. There's a huge difference, and the Wizards just don't have that type of force in their defenders on the wings.
Yeah, I think you could, would you call it a structural problem for them at this point?
Well, you'd have to say so, because Porter is not there. Oubre doesn't have anywhere near the discipline, although he has the physical tools with a 7'2 wingspan. And Beal is too short to deal with someone like DeRozan. And I thought, so that is definitely a concern, the Wizards defense there. They're also like pretty aggressive, gave up a fair amount of open threes to Toronto as well. And then they only got up 10 threes on their own. Now, part of that was because they're staying home in the pick and roll and the 3-point shooters. And then Wall was slicing them up at the rim, so that's part of why he had such a good game, because they were taking away the three-pointer, but it was still you got to get up more threes than that if you hope to win in today's NBA. A couple of smaller notes on this one. Norman Powell played basically, I want to say, if not the last 14 minutes of the game. He closed down the stretch. They actually put him on Wall, and he did a better job after Lowry was not able to get the job done. They also didn't really go under on Wall at all, which I would have thought they would have done considering the issues with his jump shot. But they're also really good. He and Gortat have such great chemistry at this point at rescreening, getting in the lane anyway, even when you do go under. So that's not exactly like a fail-safe strategy against John Wall the way it is against some other more limited Elfrid Payton type of point guards who can't shoot.
Yeah, I mean, they can make it work either way. And the challenging thing there is just kind of, can they force a collapse? Because they can create for each other. But ideally, I mean, you can think about pick and rolls in a lot of different ways. And then there was an interesting piece by Scott Rafferty today on how the Pistons actually do it even more differently, because sometimes they create offensive rebounds for themselves. But it can really help when you can create for other guys. But when a team stays home, really, you're relying a lot on those two individuals to put up the points.
Otto Porter did have a nice game in this one, but only took one three-point attempt. He was mostly getting out in transition. He hit the offensive glass really hard. He had four offensive rebounds. Looked really good there. Just did a great job of cutting in behind the defense as well on pick and roll. So he looked really good. Markieff Morris really did not give them anything on either end. He was not able to really defend much in pick and roll. And then his ISOs really weren't going anywhere. And that's the concern about Markieff, is if he's not going to be able to hit threes, he was one out of two, but not a huge threat out there still at this point. Then how's he going to score efficiently? He doesn't get to the foul line a ton. He's not really big enough that he's just going to beast guys inside. So he's kind of relying on his mid-range jumper to go in. And they tried to use him as the guy who could give him some scoring on that second unit in the first quarter when they were getting lit up, and he really wasn't able to create anything there, which is not a huge surprise. He's not like some unbelievable guy in that role.
No, I mean, even from back in his days in Phoenix, he always seemed like a guy who was better at taking advantage of a situation that had already been created, which is a useful skill set, but not the same thing.
You could tell that the Wizards really wanted this game. They'd even been,
especially early.
I forget who said it. It was like, hey, this is a must win. They now go to 0-3. And Scott Brooks, all of the starters played at least 36 minutes in this one. And they really, you know, Oubre played 7 minutes. Nicholson played 9 minutes. He kind of struggled to finish it at the rim at times. And Thornton and Satoransky, I think they really, and then the 43 minutes for Gortat is a pretty huge number for a guy. I think he's 32 right now. So they really need Mahimi to come back. I think he can help with some of their defensive issues a little bit as well, to give them some more help defense at the rim against some players. But they really did not look good defensively in this one. All right, we'll get to Boston and Chicago momentarily. But first, a word from Indochino. Indochino has been a longtime sponsor of the podcast, and they've worked perfectly for me because I'm somewhat of an oddly shaped guy at 6'6". Off-the-rack suits have never fit me. I have kind of big shoulders, but not that big of a chest. So to get enough room for my shoulders, then the whole suit is like a tent on me. And Indochino really fixed that for me. I went into their store. They have one here in San Francisco, and they measured me out. It was a fantastic, easy process. Only took about 20 minutes. I was able to go through all their fabrics in person, customize my suit. I actually got this nice three-piece that I was getting some compliments on at the Warriors opener last week. And the best part about it is it's actually going to be a lot less expensive than some expensive department store suits that aren't actually even going to fit you as well. Basically, you can get any premium Indochino suit for just $389 at Indochino.com when entering that familiar cap space code. Easy to remember because we talk about cap space all the time on the program. So it's Indochino.com, promo code cap space for any premium suit for just $389, and of course, free shipping. If you're an international listener, they actually ship internationally as well. So you don't have to worry about bad fitting suits or making expensive trips to the tailor to get it right, and you have to go back a bunch of times. This is just going to fit, even if there's not a store near you. You can do the measurements yourself. There's a tutorial on their website. Send them in and they will hook you up. It'll be, I think, the best suit that you've ever owned. Chicago and Boston now. The most memorable part of this game was Amir Johnson's ridiculous three-point outburst in the third quarter.
Yeah, there were a couple of those tonight. We didn't really watch and cover that game, but Brook Lopez had one against the Pistons as well.
Yeah, Johnson is someone who always teased a little bit with his three-pointer, but it takes him an hour to get it off. He looked like at the start of last year, moving to the Celtics, a more perhaps three-point friendly team, that he might get there, but still was a little hesitant to take it. And he just got going from the corners, hit a couple, then he hit one with a guy all over him for his fourth one. And then he also had one of the most ridiculous hook shots I've ever seen on a post-up, where he started on the right block, dribbled under the rim, basically picked up his dribble as he was traversing under the rim, ended up on the opposite block, taking two steps to go to a hook shot. It was basically a fadeaway hook shot, and somehow was able to drop that in. And that they really needed his production, because they started he and Tyler Zeller together. Olynyk, of course, is still out, and Al Horford is in the concussion protocol because he sustained potentially a concussion in practice on Monday, so he was out as well. And then Marcus Smart, kind of, this was his first game back, he kind of tweaked his ankle, although he was able to return. So the Celtics were playing shorthanded, but they're able to get a great performance from Johnson. The Bulls defense did not look good in this one at all. Isaiah Thomas was able to score very efficiently against them also. And while the Bulls did mount a rather furious rally at the end to tie it up, Boston was in control of this game most of the way.
And I think the other big thing with this is Jay Crowder's sprained ankle, just because Boston is already dealing.
Oh yeah, that's who I forgot about them being shorthanded. That's right. I knew it was someone other than
Jay Crowder got hurt, I believe it was in the second quarter. And so, you know, that's also in-game injuries can be even harder to adjust because you have that. And so that is also what I think played a major role, not only in Marcus Smart having his return game, welcome back to the regular season, you play almost 34 minutes off the bench, and then Jarebko actually played a lot of minutes as well. And, you know, I think that from what I saw, they were both fine. You know, they did what you needed in order to still win this game.
Yeah, I mean, for them to have guys like Zeller, who wasn't really very good today, he was 5 out of 11 and didn't play with a ton of force, only had 4 rebounds, and they were giving up some on the offensive glass when he was in. He wasn't blocking any shots, but he's at least, you know, not going to absolutely kill you as a center. And he's pretty much, I think, their fifth or even sixth big on this team. For Crowder, it did not look good, that ankle injury. The only saving grace is it was his left ankle. The high ankle sprain he sustained last year was his right ankle. So at least this isn't have the potential of re-aggravating that previous injury. And for the Bulls, they played their guys a fair amount of minutes. Jimmy Butler, 36. He was 8 out of 21 from the field. Had some moments, but also struggled to really be too efficient. Rondo was 6 of 11, but I think a well-earned negative 11 for him with 4 turnovers. And he did a little bit of too much of assist hunting as well. Had one really bad play where they could have tied the game up late, and they ran a 1-3 pick and roll to get Isaiah Thomas onto Dwayne Wade, exactly what you want, to get Wade down in the post. And then Rondo instead just went to the other side of the floor and took an awful mid-ranger that airballed. And that was really kind of the last gasp for the Bulls at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Bulls had, as much as I want to celebrate their success at the very beginning of the season, they had a little bit of a charmed life. And this was also a game where they didn't get more transition opportunities than their opponents. And that is an important kind of aspect of their success in the first three games. And, you know, if they can keep doing that, it will certainly help. But, you know, fast break points were 14 to 13. The Bulls had fewer steals than the Celtics because everyone has fewer steals than the Celtics. And so it was more of an equal playing field. And that led right into Boston, especially being the home team.
Yeah, Wade played a lot of minutes. He played 35 minutes as well. Wasn't really able to get going against some of those really good Boston wing defenders. Marcus Smart did a nice job on him when he was in the game. And the Bulls really, as I said, were down by 10 most of the game. They got back into it using a front court of Nikola Mirotic and Bobby Portis. Taj Gibson was really bad. He was 3 out of 12 and also had 4 turnovers, though he did get on the offensive glass for 5 offensive rebounds. So he was bad. But then, yeah, all right, that unit got him back into the game. But I'm sorry, there's just no universe in which Bobby Portis is a better player than Taj Gibson. And once they got back into it, they started really exploiting Portis defensively. They didn't have any rim protection in the game. That Mirotić and Gibson front court has been pretty solid for them so far this year. And even on defense only possessions down the end of a close game, Hoiberg did not go back to Gibson. And this was one of those ones where, especially because Portis had to play a bunch of minutes in a row as well, it was just, all right, I realize this is the unit that got you back in the game, but how about we look at like the 10-year career of Taj Gibson and the 1+ year career of Bobby Portis and know what their strengths and weaknesses are and just say that, hey, there's nothing special that happened here that magically made Bobby Portis a better player than Taj Gibson in the last 10 minutes. Much as you might want to have it, someone who has played well deserves to stay in. That's true when those guys are pretty close in stature and Gibson and Portis are not. And they gave up a lot of shots at the rim late that I think Gibson could have helped with.
What did you think about the injury replacement guys that got more minutes for the Bulls today? So Cannon, Grant, and Valentine.
Yeah, McDermott was out in the concussion protocol as well. Valentine, I didn't get to see that much of because I was really focused on that Wizards-Toronto game at that point. Jerian Grant played well. He was plus 10, 3 out of 3. He was a big part of an initial Bulls run to get back into it after they gave up 36 points in the first quarter. So he was pretty good in the second quarter. And you could tell that Boston's bench was a little depleted because usually Boston's bench will hurt people. They have better depth than most teams, but here the Bulls bench actually really outplayed their bench. Jaylen Brown, despite the fact that Smart was hurt and Crowder was out, did not play at all in the second half. He picked up 4 fouls in the first half, really struggled to guard Jimmy Butler. So that was a nice little lesson for him, a reminder that he's definitely a rookie. And I felt that Terry Rozier continues to impress. He looks like a totally decent backup point guard right now. And that's considering how cheap he's going to be going forward for a team that wants to use cap space, or maybe as another guy who can be an asset, I think he could be pretty useful.
That also has lingering significant importance on the idea if Marcus Smart can then play more of the off-guard role. And defensively, his versatility is incredible. I mean, he had moments on Paul Millsap in last year's playoffs. And if you can think of Marcus Smart more as a perimeter guy and not as somebody who you have to run your offense through, I think that opens him up a little bit, even if he still has shooting trouble, because I don't really trust him to create offense yet.
Yeah, Smart is basically like a three defensively.
Pretty much.
He can really guard one through three totally well, and even switch on to some fours. As you noted, Smart did have a couple of unbelievable passes in this game. He had this one where he thread the needle through like four guys on the baseline to Zeller for a layup that really like made my eyes pop out of my head. Something that just didn't really seem to elicit comment from everyone, but I was like, wow, that was incredible to see that. And he had another bullet pass from the top of the key down low to someone on the baseline for a layup too. So he's got some vision. He always seems to get hurt. This team has better options at the point. I still would love to see what he could really do as the primary guy with the ball in his hands. It just doesn't seem like that's going to happen for him necessarily anytime soon in Boston, but he does enough other things to stay on the court as well.
So if, let's say Jay Crowder misses a week, would you start Marcus at the three?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, huh? I think they might give Jaylen Brown the kind of start you the first 8 minutes and never bring you back in rookie start instead. I mean, if that kind of helps boost his trade value a little bit, maybe, which is important. Also lets him work as a secondary guy. If he's going to try to be the guy with the ball in his hands, he's better at this point because he's prone to really drive into a lot of traffic. Playing off the starters, he's been hitting his three-pointer okay on spot-ups. He's not going to be pressed as much defensively in that role, hopefully. And then he can kind of catch the ball with a seam and attack and go right to the rim and finish, whereas he might have a little bit too much pressure on him as the main guy on bench units. So that's probably what I would do, especially considering that Smart just came back from the sprained ankle, and him playing 34 minutes, as you mentioned, in his first game back was not necessarily ideal.
Yeah, the only kind of exception team, and I don't know Boston's schedule well enough to know if they face them in the near term, would be somebody like Toronto, because you could hide Isaiah somewhere else and then put Smart and Avery Bradley on their guys. But there aren't that many teams that have a one and two that are so good offensively that you really have to game plan for it. I mean, Portland would be another one, but there aren't that many of those teams.
Dwayne Wade 0 for 3 on threes, by the way, today, which is we'll see where it comes back to work. The other thing that's interesting is Robin Lopez really has not been closing either half. He's been playing basically one stint, only 14 minutes in this one. This was not the game for him with Johnson hitting those threes, because they actually close with Jarebko and Johnson. And so there's no way you can bring, if Johnson's going to be hitting those threes, Hoiberg probably felt like, hey, there's no way Lopez can get out at anybody at the three-point line, so we're not going to bring him back in. But even before, they've been closing with Mirotić and Gibson. And so this is kind of the point to me about him being the centerpiece of that Rose trade. They've obviously have looked good so far, and I watched one of their other games. We didn't break it down. They looked awesome against the Pacers. I don't mean to take away from what their start has been, although obviously they are not going to continue shooting this ridiculous percentage on threes. Lopez is just not going to play more than like 20 minutes a game most of the time. It's just he can be played off the floor in nearly any lineup. It's hard to get him out there closing a game because a lot of teams close small, and he just cannot match up, and he's not going to punish you enough in the post. He's going to be too slow on the pick and roll. He can't switch. So he's just like kind of limited. And so this idea that, you know, he's some great contract. Yeah, he's a great contract if he's a starting center who's going to play 30 minutes a game. But I just don't think that's what he's going to be doing on this team.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way of putting it. And I would say that his salary is fair for that. But there is the idea that Chicago, you know, if they want to be players at some point in free agency, that, you know, having that kind of money tied up in a single player is a challenge. And, you know, that you have a guy who's at least nominally your starting center, I don't think he'll scare other teams' potential guys off, but you never really know.
Mirotić also was actually able to get to the line quite a bit. Oh, that actually was brought to you by my Chicago accent, which rarely makes an appearance, but I figured with the Cubs having won, we can break out and actually just to show the Chicago roots there. But Mirotić was able to actually get to the line like the way he did as a rookie. He shot 11 free throws. A lot of those were, again, just kind of his BS foul drawing. It wasn't like he was just making some great play going to the rim and getting fouled. You know, it was pump fakes. It was loose ball fouls. Avery Bradley had like a really bad loose ball foul that let Mirotić get to the foul line, and then he missed two free throws that could have tied it up. I mean, the Bulls really blew some chances in between under 2 minutes before they got into the final minute, and then Isaiah Thomas made a great layup over Portis at the rim, and that was really the go-ahead play. A beautiful right-handed shot by the lefty, and the Celtics never trailed after that. I think that was with about a minute 30 left. All right, we will be back with the more from the Reddit mailbag, but first, this word. So one of our newer sponsors, one that we've gotten some nice Twitter feedback on, is Movement Watches, MVMTWatches.com/capspace. They are not big on balls at Movement Watches, but they are big on awesome value. I guess maybe that's how they're able to sell their watches for just $95 when an equivalent watch in an apartment at a department store would be $400, $500. They do not buy any vols. And so they really believe in streamlining things, the stuff that doesn't matter, but the stuff that matters, like quality and design and quality construction, they do a great job with. They've now sold over 500,000 watches in over 160 countries. So if you're one of our international listeners, you can definitely get one as well. We even heard from a listener who got it. He was for his own wedding and really thought that it looked good. So to get something that looks that good, that'll work for a formal occasion like that, and still start at just $95 is a really fantastic value. I really love mine, the gunmetal sandstone watch. My girlfriend loves hers. My mom actually bought one as well. She needed a new watch. So the way to get started with them, MVMTWatches.com/capspace. That'll get you 15% off your order with free shipping. MVMTWatches.com/capspace is that URL. All right, let's get some more Reddit questions now, starting with this one from Trying to Contribute. What would Date Nunkin and Lanny Deroux do with the Nerlens Noel, Jahlil Okafor situation in Philly?
I'm excited we get to be coaches and GMs.
That's right.
That's usually what that means. So for me, what it really depends on is Joel Embiid. And the reason for that is that I think that Nerlens fits in better as kind of a starter, mitigating the offense on a first unit. On second unit, you kind of waste some of that and you just don't need as much of it. And so if Embiid can be like, let's say what he looked like even for moments of the game on Tuesday, then he's probably your starting center, whatever minutes he plays. And then I actually like Okafor better as the second unit guy. But the cheap answer here is what this really is. So I would prefer to keep Okafor over Noel, all other things equal. The cheap part of the answer is that all other things aren't equal and it depends on the offer you get.
Yeah, and Okafor certainly has the more controllable contract situation than Noel does. I think it's interesting to look back on this situation because this is actually the logical result of basically the math problem that Sam Hinkie was trying to solve with his strategy. Was, we're going to take a ton of bites at the apple in a row to try to find a superstar. And so even though he had drafted Embiid, even though they felt like, I think, by the time they drafted Okafor, they had realized that Embiid was going to be out for another year at that point. But then they drafted Embiid when they already had Noel, etc. And the reason for that strategy was because they felt like, we need as many bites of the apple as we can, and we got to take the best player available. It's all about just getting a superstar. They weren't even beginning to think about positional need. And so now that they do have these players, Okafor and Noel presumably have some kind of value. If Embiid actually, if you could guarantee me that Embiid were going to be really good, I would trade both those guys. But unfortunately, and I think Embiid looks good enough that I'd feel comfortable doing that, except for the fact, of course, that he still has these issues with the foot. He's on a minutes restriction right now. I mean, he really would have to get through this year completely healthy, and then maybe even the beginning of next year before I feel like, all right, for sure, we're going to just count on this guy and move someone else. But on the other hand, you can say, hey, maybe Okafor just isn't good enough to even be a championship quality starting center. So we should just, you might even really try to move both those guys, I think, is probably what I ultimately would come up with there. But they're also trying to not suck this year, and that's a part of the component as well.
It's nice that Rashawn Holmes is getting a little bit of time, partially due to the staggered rest coupled with Noel's injury, because he's another part of this. Because while I don't think he's, a key piece on a great team, the Sixers certainly aren't there yet. And if you need a player to sop up, 10 to 15 minutes, if you traded both those guys, he can certainly do that. And so,
yeah,
that,
he could maybe even play 20 minutes on a bad team.
Sure.
We like him as a prospect. He's not there yet as being like a real good player.
And you can always get role. like, you can always kind of try out different, you know, different kind of guys. I mean, I've beat the Robert Upshaw drum for years, but, you know, just kind of guys like that, when you get a little bit later in the season, just cycle through 10-day contracts. So if you, especially on a bad team, I think that's a good use of a roster spot. So if they did move both of them, it wouldn't hurt them catastrophically as long as Embiid stayed healthy more in the long term than the short term.
Yeah, because this year, if you move both of them, and also Okafor has got to rebuild his value a little bit too. I mean, and he is, this knee issues that he are having are a little bit concerning to me. It may end up being something he gets past, but it's been quite a while now with the surgery. He had a setback in camp. He's still on restrictions, etc. So we're going to have to see a lot from him even to get him back to last year's level, to where he might even be tradable. But if you were to move both those guys, now Embiid's playing 24 minutes of games in the games that he is playing, and then Holmes is playing for, and then nobody really behind him. I don't think they even have someone who would qualify as a third center on the roster if they were to move Noel and Okafor. So with all that being the case, I think I probably am just going to hold on to all of them for the time being. And if you get something that's like a pretty good first rounder for Noel, then I might move him, you know, even a lottery protected first rounder. You might do it at this point, especially with some of the health concerns that he has. But otherwise, I just kind of hold on, and you just got to play the lottery still. There's still the chance that Embiid might not be healthy. You can go into restricted free agency with Noel. You have one of those guys as a pretty good backup. That's probably good too. I mean, Embiid is probably never going to be playing more than 30 minutes a game for the next like 3 or 4 years, even, you would think, until they're ready to compete. So you're going to need a good backup. And I'm not really in a rush to trade any of them, even though, of course, there are those redundancies right now.
Question for you. Knowing, let's say even knowing what we know now, if you were the Washington Wizards at the deadline last year, would you have rather had Markieff Morris or would you have rather had Nerlens?
Probably Markieff, just because he's going to be healthy, because they just had nothing else at power forward and there weren't really any options on the power forward market this year. I guess even for the amount of money that they paid Mahinmi, they weren't able to get a Marvin Williams or a Dang or someone like that. That probably would have been out of their price range and a worse contract than what they ended up giving Mahinmi. Centers are easier to get, and Markieff is locked in for about $8 million or so these next 3 years, whereas Noel, you might have gotten this 1 year out of him. And then, because remember, they also were trying to make the playoffs last year, and I think Markieff helped them more in that respect. And then I think he helps them more this year too, especially with the injury concerns and the fact that he's redundant with Gortat. And then Noel is going to get much more expensive than Markieff after that. So probably would have rather had Markieff.
And we're also getting a little bit away from the idea of Nerlens being this super high-end potential defensive force. You know, like, he can still be a positive on that end. I believe he will be. But the idea of him being like a defensive player of the year candidate seems, to me, it feels more distant than it did before. And that's the upside.
Is that fair, though? Why does it feel more distant? Other than the fact, I mean, because there's two things that have taken him off that track. We felt great about him after his second year. He played, I think, like 76 games. That year, the Sixers were 12th in defense, in large part due to what he was able to do. And then, of course, he played most of last year with Okafor, and now he's been hurt. I mean, those are the two things that have changed. I don't know that his talent has changed necessarily.
Yeah, it might be an unfair perception. You might be right. I think that I did see a little bit less from him last year, but you are right that the context, it matters there, and that he was playing a lot with Okafor, and that was certainly a bad situation, especially because Noel's value to me is as a center, you know, like defensively, yeah. is doing that. And I want to take a look back at his rebounding numbers, because that's all, I always like those guys who can protect the rim and rebound. But yeah, you're right. You're right about the idea that they were 12th there, and it's not like the rest of their team was real gangbusters defensively, though they had no offensive talent, and they did have kind of more of those limited defense guys. But, you know, that's okay. But yeah, I mean, that also is part of the reason why, you know, depending on how they're approaching this, it might be worthwhile to do a buy low for another team, just because if the Sixers are considering not matching a high offer, then you're playing a risky game if a team offers you, like, let's say, like a 20 something, like 21, 22 first round pick. That's a pretty good thing to be giving up, like, let's say, you know, in January or something, if you already like your other two guys.
The one thing that has gone out the window, I think, for Noel is hope that he was going to develop a jump shot. I think that's, you know, there's great talk about him reworking his shot, and I think it's pretty clear that is not anywhere close to materializing at this point. I will also say that I think Noel is probably the biggest beneficiary of what are going to be the new restricted free agency rules, because there are going to be teams that really need him. He's also also young enough of a building block to where even bad teams are going to want him. And there are a lot of bad teams that don't really have any kind of a center prospect. Brooklyn, even Phoenix, although again, they supposedly red flagged him in the draft process. There are a lot of these bad teams that could really use him and that don't really have much other use for their cap space. So they figure, hey, we'll take a chance on this guy. And then they're not a good enough team to where they're going to be in it for the top guys anyway. So, all right, if we waste 2 days of our cap space here, we'll still be, you know, kind of scrounging on the dregs of the market at the end of that point anyway. So those 2 days of opportunity cost don't hurt as much as it would for a team maybe with some higher aspirations. So I think he's really going to benefit from the new structure.
He should. And if he wanted to wait for a team like Boston, that would be allowed as well. But the risk there is just that the market dries up.
What's next?
Can I do the next question?
Yeah.
Okay. From Barcavius Meme O. He classified as a fun joke question, but I actually think it's interesting, which is, if LeBron was a free agent and he said he only wanted to play 12 minutes a game the entire fourth quarter in order to prolong his career, what offers would he get and from who? Is he still a max player?
He would have gotten a ton of offers in last year's free agency because there were good teams that already would be able to get to the fourth quarter and then add him into the mix for those 12 minutes. He doesn't really help you that much if you're using that max spot. And remember, this is a 35% max for him too. So that's a lot of room. You know, we're not talking about 25% max here. This is a $35 million salary. It's hard to get to the fourth quarter to be in position where he can actually help you if you're already bad. So you'd want it to be a team that had some vets already. It's going to be pretty good. I mean, Minnesota would be a pretty awesome one. You would imagine they would jump on it in a heartbeat. They have enough young talent. Boston might be hard pressed to fit him. I guess they would have to dump Olynyk, which I think they'd probably be.
Well, I was thinking more last summer, like, because for me last summer, if Durant hadn't gone to the Warriors would have done it for a series of different reasons. But like last summer, Boston would have done it because they already had the space. And then, you know, a lot of like kind of those mid-tier teams, it probably would have done it as well.
But if the team is too good already, then like, oh, we're going to just put him in for the fourth quarter and change up everything. He's got to have the ball in his hands. I mean, Boston really is the perfect one, right? Because they don't have that type of creator, but they're good enough to stay in the game until the fourth quarter. Like that's the obvious one there. And Minnesota maybe being another one, just as a young team that's going to struggle to close out wins. He's certainly a max player just because having him on your team makes things more serious as well. I mean, from a marketing standpoint, from a worth of the franchise standpoint, absolutely is. In terms of like his actual value, probably not worth a 35% max, but probably would be worth like a 25% max, I would say, just because of what he can. It's just so top heavy. Kevin Pelton would probably be a better guy to answer this question from a mass standpoint of just, you know, if you basically say whatever LeBron's season long warp would be. I mean, I guess it would be a third of it because if he's playing 36 minutes a game, and then you multiply that, I guess, so you're probably by the fact that he's playing the highest leverage minutes. So he's probably maybe worth like half of what he's worth, I think, is kind of a way to think about it. If he's only playing those last 12 minutes, and if he's worth half of what he is, I mean, he's probably a $60 million player right now. He's probably pretty darn close to worth the max. And then when you throw in the fact that all the marketing stuff, there are plenty of teams who would jump on that for sure.
There's another big thing to throw in, and that's that nobody else gets him. You know, it's part of the reason that I argued for the Durant stuff is the nuclear deterrence, is that when you get a player like that, they're not in Cleveland, they're not on wherever else. And so, especially for a team like Boston, like all of a sudden you take away one of your other competitors, gives you somebody who matches up well against basically every single team. And I think he's still worth the max for the right team, but for, you know, like the Sixers, no, except for from a marketing perspective.
He could also just play the four that whole fourth quarter because he would have a ton of energy. And
he could play the five.
Yeah, him playing at like his full defensive intensity for that, just that fourth quarter, would be pretty remarkable. I think he would really become, again, one of the league's best defensive players on a regular basis if he were doing that. So I chastised you the other day for something completely unrealistic, but considering that's the point of this Reddit mailbag, to just ask whatever you want, good question from Barkevius. Let's go to Celtics Big Four. If the Celtics draft Fultz, Smith Jr., or Smart and Rozier develop more, will the Celtics look to trade Isaiah Thomas?
So you're getting, this question is kind of aiming at the idea of more about what they will do rather than what they should do. So I'm going to take the questioner at their word. And I don't think so, because they're trying to win now. I think we might have talked about this a little bit before, but the fundamental challenge for the Celtics, and you know, this is still in light of everything, like especially with Marcus Smart just coming back from injury tonight, is that you need, if you're competitive, you need to have those minutes. And also, I don't think that he's super valued around the league at this point. I mean, he's getting he's on this cheap contract, which is great, but the surplus value is getting real thin there because he's going to be a free agent at the end of next year. So if you're not getting something huge there, and also Boston has this just arsenal of draft assets already, so there are some diminishing returns, though there aren't that many diminishing returns. I mean, they're actually seeing that with the guys that they have overseas and everything like that. So they'd consider it, and they should consider it. But I just recorded a podcast with Sam Vecenie on these draft guys. But a general kind of consensus point, as good as Fultz and Dennis Smith will probably be, is that it's going to take them some time.
It takes every rookie point guard except for Chris Paul and Magic Johnson basically in history some time. So, and there's two reasons that they wouldn't end up doing it. One is, as you said, that they have to compete next year, and you're not going to get really, and also he occupies such a unique position of need for them in the fact that he's the only creator that they have who can do anything with the ball in his hands, the only guy really that you look at as a threat running pick and roll. The rookies would not be good enough to contribute next year, as we said. And then also, the way trades generally work in the NBA is you're trading someone who's good now for future assets. And Thomas's value isn't going to be that high. That great contract that he's on, by next year, he'll be a free agent in the summer of 2018. He said to want a lot of money, and justifiably so. So is he really even going to bring you that much back? Like maybe some future first rounder that's lottery protected at that point? You know, we talked about how comparing him to Goran Dragic and what he ended up getting for the Suns, and he probably is going to be older and potentially also like less likely to re-sign than Dragic was in Miami, which ended up being for a discount. So with all that being the case, you're not going to get good enough value back to forgo the chance of even competing, or even if you're only going to be a 50-win-ish team next year. So I think it is very unlikely that he would get moved on. And even if they brought a superior point guard in over the top of him, just being able to bring him off the bench as a scorer, I think you're still not going to get equal value for him, even in that role.
Yeah, the only way I was thinking about it that it would change it a little bit is if they could get a potential primary creator at a different position. Like if they could get, you know, theoretically like a James Harden or something like that, because then you get more into a direct conflict. But even then, unless you're getting a really nice first round pick, having Isaiah Thomas as the favorite for sixth man of the year would be huge for them, especially when you condense playoff rotations.
Yeah, maybe if he's part of some big package to bring back somebody else and then he gets flipped again, something along those lines for a star. That's the only way I could see it happening, where they're just going to have so much creation at that point. It's not going to be because, oh yeah, we got this rookie and he's going to be good for us, we got the position filled now. It's going to take a while for anyone who comes in there. Let's go now to Noble Pilsner. Does Oklahoma City trade Enes Kanter before the trade deadline?
No, there isn't really a market for him. Oklahoma City has a role for him. He fits in reasonably well.
The fact that they traded Ilyasova, like they have nobody, I think they're going to want to play Adams and Kanter together a ton. Kanter, for all of his flaws, is way better than anyone else that they have at the four right now. So you got to play those guys together if they're trying to compete. Maybe if they really fall out of it, they could move him. And then the other way we thought that they might try and get rid of him was to open up cap space this summer. And now that they extended Adams, they extended Oladipo, that's looking less likely as well. So no, I think, and then does he even pass your Nene test? Maybe not. So I think all of those factors make me believe it is pretty unlikely.
Something very amusing is that he could be a free agent at the end of next season, and he fits the idea of players who opt out even if they might not get the annual value, because there's a lot more security in that. So if he has a good season, let's say next season, then he's probably going to opt out. He'll have a really high cap hold, and he, you know, he's going to want years and dollars. So if you trade for him, you're getting a very short-term thing, and neither of us feel that he can be a starting center on a successful team right away. And you know, if that ever happens, happens, it'll take a lot of time. And so why would Oklahoma City, you know, unless a team just makes a mistake offer, and that's why you never take this sort of thing off the table, you know, maybe somebody's going to offer you the equivalent of what they got for, not for Serge Ibaka, but, you know, like a scaled down version. If someone overvalues your asset, you listen. But Enes Kanter is not the right type of player for that to happen because he is not a scarcity at all.
Where are we going next?
So I don't think it necessarily connects with this, but Check It Miles asked, what teams do you think are most likely to go all in and make a big win now trade this season? And then also, what players do you think will be available for that type of trade?
Well, there are two types of teams that might do this. The ones that have assets and are trying to be good. So that's Boston. We've been talking about them plenty of times. And then there are also the teams that have a lot of pressure to win now and look better. Orlando is the one that really comes to mind for me. They've had really not a very good start to the year. They need some more shooting. Maybe we could see them rejigger things to go back to playing Gordon at the four, if this playing him at the three it isn't really working, or at least more of a combo forward type of look for Orlando. And jobs, by all accounts, well, I shouldn't say all accounts, but all appearances are on the line there. So those are the ones. And then your typical guys who are about to be free agents. And there are not that many of those who are on bad teams at the moment who are really going to make much of a difference. The Hawks have started well. So you have to imagine if they continue to play well, their defense has been outstanding so far. They have the best defense in the league with Dwight Howard back there. If they, Paul Millsap would be one to move. If Orlando just goes so bad, maybe Serge Ibaka is someone who could become available again if they just see the writing on the wall and we're just not going to be good this year. We're going to turn towards development. I think if they really, you know, if they are like 3-15 or something, or maybe even like, you know, 6-15 at one point, maybe we'll see that from them. But it would take a really bad record for them to go into that mode. Gallo on Denver is someone that we've talked about a lot. Rudy Gay, I don't know how much he's really going to help in for a win now all in type of move. The Bulls are playing well, so Jimmy Butler may not be available if that continues. Again, that's only three games and they're shooting the lights out on threes and their opponents aren't, so we can calm down on that a little bit. We'll see. Actually, we're recording this part of it before I watch them tonight against the Celtics, so maybe we'll have some more thoughts on how they're doing at that point. And that's about it, really. I don't see anyone else. Jrue Holiday might be another guy where if the Pels are totally out of it, then they could trade for him. But I don't know that there are any contenders necessarily that need a point guard. They're usually pretty good at point guard.
Yeah, that's a kind of a common thread. And there's a dynamic this year, which is different from some other years, where there are a series of contending teams or teams that think of themselves as contenders that would probably love to do a buy now move, but they just don't really have the assets. Toronto is maybe the most obvious one here. I mean, Toronto would love to.
Oh, yeah, the Clippers would push all the chips in a second, but they don't have the ability to get anyone who's going to make a difference.
So that's the other reason that we talk about a team like Boston, because Boston is a team that theoretically could have the demand and also has the supply of things to make it happen. And so, yeah, the Clippers are a really good example of how that can't work. And, you know, if San Antonio ever wanted to really change their roster, they certainly could. Like, it is always interesting to have a team where almost all of their contracts are desirable. And so, I believe they hold all their first round picks. And so, you know, if they ever wanted to, that just hasn't been their MO really to make those kind of swings. So you could see it, but I wouldn't expect it. And then the one other team I want to bring up, just because I personally feel that they are going to give up their first round pick in a not that kind of trade, but in a lesser tier trade, is the Washington Wizards. And the Wizards fit all the hallmarks of like a GM that might be fighting for their job, team that might be on the fringe, and the fact that they already have shown a willingness to do it because it happened last year. And since that year has passed, it's not applied to the Stepien rule. I expect them to, if they're close, to use their first round pick again this year to get somebody else.
Some players that could fall into that category: Sam Presti moving on from Roberson would be a very Sam Presti move now that they weren't able to agree on an extension. We speculated yesterday that maybe Grant is kind of their cheapo Roberson replacement. So you could see maybe a team like the Clippers might want to get onto him, although again, he has the same limitations as Mbah Mute, but he brings more to the table than someone like
Wait, Mbah can I give you a Roberson team?
Yeah.
Denver.
Yeah, that's not bad. They could use
they have excess picks. They could use a guy like him. They have plenty of money flexibility. Like, I think that's a great fit.
Yeah, I could see Shabazz Muhammad being another guy who could get moved as well. Macklemore, we talked about. Omri Caspi, he's kind of been injured, but he's also been not really in the rotation very much. I think a smart team would try to get onto him if the king, depending on what's happening with the Kings.
Everyone on the Suns that wasn't drafted in the last 2 years.
Deion Waiters could be movable also if Miami falls out of things. He's got that second year player option at the room exception. So about $3 million next year that Miami might just be worried he's going to pick up and want to get off of for even a relatively free return. Not, you probably wouldn't take much to get someone like Waiters.
Well, and one other thing I wanted to bring up was talking with the Lockdown Blazers guys last night about the possibility that they clarify their front court rotation. And they're in a nice spot where, depending on team valuations, there will be a market for all their guys. You know, if they wanted to move on from Myers Leonard, they could probably find a taker. If they want to move on from Mason Plumlee, Ed Davis, kind of whoever. And beyond the fact that they just have a minutes crunch, just the idea of allocating those resources a different way, considering they have no salary cap flexibility, they could find a mutually beneficial trade, even though I can't really see it right now.
Dallas is 0-3 right now, and if they fall out of it, I could see them moving Bogut as well. But again, we're kind of going too far afield from the question, because these are not very sexy win now all in type of moves. Like, there's nobody among these names who are being discussed to me where you're going to do what I would consider an all in type of trade. And it's rare that we'll see those sorts of trades as well, because there aren't that many superstars who are available and worthy of that.
Well, yeah, when you see those, it's more something like Harden, where the guy isn't there yet and a team makes that sort of a move, which was a very different thing.
Jack DeMann. Hey, Nate, I think being drafted to the wrong team or wrong system can kill a player's career, or being drafted to the right team can facilitate success. Can you think of two or three examples of players drafted to the wrong or right team? I will start with one. This might make some Knicks fans angry. Kristaps Porzingis is looking like he might be drafted to the wrong team,
especially with the way they've reacted to his success, which was I commented on a Frank Iosola tweet about the idea of that seems like the only people who don't know that Porzingis is their best player is the Knicks.
And and I think that's probably true. And you know, it's Derrick Rose taking as many shots as he wants with his usual 48 true shooting percentage. It's Carmelo still isolating a lot, just not enough pick and pop with Porzingis to really get him going, to use him like a Dirkish player who can defend. And if they just had some more shooting around him, if they're just playing a spread pick and roll style, trying to build around him with young guys, I think we're always going to talk about. I mean, I don't see any way that this Knicks team really gets there. I mean, maybe they can get some awesome point guard in free agency next year and that changes things. But I mean, just that Noah contract, he's looked awful so far this year, and they only 4 more years left of that. By the way, he hasn't even been worth the money so far this year yet. A lot of not playing him at center, although I think he should probably be splitting his time about equally at this point in his career, but will eventually move to center long before that Noah contract expires. All that really, it looks like, both from a fit standpoint and a just getting enough people around him to actually compete standpoint, not looking too good right now.
From a good standpoint, one that I can speak to because I followed the entire thing firsthand, is Klay Thompson. Thompson was given the support early on to kind of develop at whatever pace, and also the idea, which you have to give Mark Jackson and his coaching staff a lot of credit for, of embracing his desire to be a better defender and using that to have him go after both guard positions. That is something that, for a guy Klay's size, very few teams would have really thought about doing that and seriously considering it. And giving him those reps at a younger age really did help set the table for the confidence to do that in big situations later on.
I've got another good one who was on the wrong team for a long time. Draymond Green. He spent 2 years being used mostly as a three, as a defensive stopper, not someone who's a good enough shooter really to play the three. Never really had the ball in his hands to pass at all. Wasn't ever told like, hey, you can grab and go. Wasn't asked to defend power forwards that much. Wasn't really used to switch out on the perimeter that much. And then even Steve Kerr wasn't using him that way either. And it was only due to the fortuity of a severe hamstring injury to David Lee that he was put into that position, and they started killing. So now he's on the perfect right team, perfect fit. People talk about him as being some system player. I think that's ridiculous. But for a long time, he was being completely misused. He could have been so much better, and it seemed like he came out of nowhere. I'm sure he did improve in that 14-15 season, to be sure, but he didn't improve that much. He still would have helped the previous year, and he did help when they actually used him correctly and started him in that Clippers series. That turned that series, and they almost won that. So he was being used completely wrong. And if that Lee knee injury never happens, maybe he never becomes close to the player that he would have been. So it's amazing how tenuous it can be for some guys, although that's quite an extreme example.
Bob Vigueras, I still think his tweet on that was just the fact that he was bold enough to say it, that they were a David Lee injury away, was one of the most, it was a gutsy call, but it was completely right. And another guy with the wrong team, right team, without changing franchises is Zach LaVine. Zach LaVine was being used completely incorrectly as a backup point guard, primary ball handler, and we're starting to see now that playing him off ball opens up in transition. But, you know, there is an argument that playing him out helped a little bit just because he got a little bit tighter with his handle. But it was just wrong situation that eventually turned into the right situation when they actually added a point guard to push him to the correct spot.
Right team from the get-go is Kawhi Leonard.
Yep.
The Spurs performing surgery on his jump shot, starting him in a small role as a defensive stopper and an energy guy, gradually ramping him up every year to now becoming clearly one of the top five players in the league, if not a top three player in the league. I mean, just what they've done with him has been masterful. If he goes somewhere else, maybe he's just, you know, he could be like Andre Robertson or something somewhere else, you know. I mean, that's about the type of shooter that he was in college. Frankly, he was had about the same kind of a reputation, played the four just like Robertson did, a little more athleticism than Robertson, but what he's done with his ball skills, tightened up his handle, his ISO scoring, is one of the best ISO scorers in the league. Nobody would have ever saw that coming, and the way that Pop and the Spurs have nurtured him, even if we complain every once in a while about the way Pop does his rotations, the fact that they have been able to develop him and develop all these players to be contributors the way that they have, it is pretty remarkable.
One thing for people who want to get a better sense of the, let's call it, less basketball side of this that is still team related. For Jonathan Abrams' book, Boys Among Men, does a great job of talking about the ways that teams supported or did not support high school kids that made the jump, Al Harrington being on the positive side and a slew of guys on more on the negative end. And it gives you a great sense of just how that mentorship can work and everything like that. And that's a big part of what leads to success with young guys as well.
Dame Lillard is another right team guy. He got drafted into a team that desperately needed a point guard, someone who could create off the dribble. They didn't have really anyone else who could do that. He was playing with LaMarcus Aldridge, got thrown into just a great guy to do pick and pops with because you got to stick to him on those plays. A lot of gravity. He had Batum and Wes Matthews as shooters around him, a nice big center as well. And he didn't have any competition for minutes, just got thrown right into the fire, led rookies, I think, in minutes. He might have even led like the league in minutes or something, I think, as a rookie, and was just off and running and continued to develop. Obviously a guy who works really hard and is high character and may have succeeded in other places, but he was put into the perfect situation. And then two point guards that come to mind, Elfrid Payton and Michael Carter Williams, are two guys who I think have some skills, especially on the defensive end, can score a little bit, have size to switch defensively. But they're guys who can't shoot, and then those weaknesses are really exacerbated by the fact that they've gone to teams that can't shoot either. Every team that those guys have been around every season has been a shooting challenge team.
I think we could also put Justice Winslow on the right team thing, just because Spoelstra had a good idea of how to use him right away, and somebody who has his strengths and weaknesses might be misused in a lot of circumstances, and that combination with Deng in particular, as a rookie, was inspired.
If I thought Willie Cauley-Stein had any type of hope, I might have put him on the wrong team just because they already had
Cousins. You could just use Stauskas and McLemore instead. I mean, those guys, I think, both got sabotaged by just how hopeless that situation was and the presence of the other guy.
Yeah, and Cousins, too. I mean, some of what you hear about the way that he is just really hard on new young guys who come into the team, especially McLemore, Stauskas, those guys are not guys who have the greatest confidence in the world. And so going there, I think, really hurt them just from a mental standpoint.
That makes me so scared for Scal.
Well, he'll be spending most of his year in Reno, so it won't be an issue. All right, I think we got one more here. What do you think of the PER stat? Is there anything it doesn't take into account? Are there any better statistics out there, and what are they? All right, so PER, basically, it's what's called a linear weights metric. So every box score statistic, it basically assigns it to a certain value to it based on what John Hollinger thought was a pretty logical formula. There are definitely some tweaks to it, but I think it does a pretty decent job of measuring as best you can in that sort of a metric what it really accounts for efficiency, it accounts for pace. That's what made it such a revolutionary metric, and it also scaled for minutes. The league average is 15, so above 15 is supposed to be a pretty good PR. So there are, so, and we'll get to some of the weaknesses at first, but even when you're just looking at box score stuff, some of the metrics have moved beyond that now. Like, I know Kevin Pelton's warp statistic that tries to give a boost for things like three-point shooting, where it's shown that three-point shooters stretch the floor and help other players, and so that tries to account for that a little bit, making it more of an approximation of value. Box plus minus does a similar thing, where they try to use the box score as a proxy for what your on-off value is, your RPM might be. So those are probably better metrics at this point, but BR also came out in like 2001, so yeah. I mean, I bought his original book, I think, that year, so it's a 15-year-old metric. You're always going to have better stuff from then on. And then what is
especially it, what yeah. inspired it, I mean, like, that it inspired other things. I mean, that's just generally something, one of the measures of something in this world being impactful is the idea that something better than it or different comes along. And I like PER. I think that there are some things that it does well, but I like to illustrate the shortcomings of it with one player, and that player is Monte Ellis, because PER, it has a threshold in terms of like where a guy's efficiency has to be for any shot to be to be rewarded for more usage. And Monte, as I recall from when he was on the Warriors and shortly thereafter, was kind of right on that threshold. So he got a little bit of a benefit from that. But also, the guy is just an unbelievably terrible defender. A lot of people use Kevin Martin for that criticism, but for me, Monte was a better articulation of it.
Yeah, just in terms of just measuring like when a guy is useful to his team, even just based on the box score stats, it probably prefers high usage guys a little bit too much. As you said, you can be really below average efficiency and using a ton of possessions, and PER will probably give you too much credit for that. It should raise really that bar. That was Ellis. And then the other example that's a perfect one is Enes Kanter, as a guy who is in the top 10 in PER, really, I think the last 2 years, and obviously is nowhere near a top 10 player in the NBA, because everything that doesn't show up in the box score doesn't show up in PER. So that's team defense, it's stopping guys at the rim, it's your ability to shoot, your gravity, your screen setting, whether you move the ball, anything that's in the floor game, basically, it's not going to capture. And that obviously is a concern with it. But I think it's useful just as a starting point where, all right, if you have a really bad PER, there better be some other stuff that's going to say this guy is really good. Your team better be awesome when you're on the floor, and, you know, maybe not as good when you're off the floor, for me to say, all right, if you have a PER that's well below the league average, there's got to be something else that you can point to. And similarly, if you have a pretty good PER, there's got to be some pretty good evidence that that's misleading. But again, you got to consider the whole totality, including using your eyes. We say all that all the time, so I won't bore you with that again. That's it.
Well, one other thing I want to say is that when you look for people who you think PER will overrate, and I'm not using that as a criticism of the stat, it's just the people who are negatives in those things and are not high in PER, that's another real big warning sign. Like, I remember, I think it was Bradley Beal 1 year, where there have been various people over time where it's like, you think, okay, well, PER is going to like them more than other things, and then you realize they still struggle in that too.
Yeah, so guys who shoot a lot and bigs are usually a little overrated in PER, and then 3-and-D type of wings, I think, are very underrated by PER. Those are the two player types that really come to mind there. All right, I think that's all we got on that one.
And that's all we got for the show. Follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Don't forget about our sponsors for today. Indochino.com, get a custom-made suit for just $389 using that cap space code. And then Movement Watches, MVMTwatches.com/capspace, get 15% off a great quality watch for far less than you'd pay for an equivalent watch at a department store. Thanks again to everyone who's giving us reviews or ratings on iTunes. All you new listeners, thanks so much for listening as well. If you got any feedback on the show, make sure you tweet me or Danny. Danny is Danny LaRue, and I, of course, am Nate Duncan, NBA. We'll be back tomorrow night with a recap of the huge Thunder-Warriors matchup. 4-0 Thunder, 3-1 Warriors. Oh, yeah, and Kevin Durant's first game against his old team. Till then.